I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, now that Don Imus is off the air, some worry that the dialogue he launched about race will go away, too. But first, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says the White House excuse for lost emails is sounding like the dog ate my homework. The emails are at the center of the investigation into the firing of 8 federal prosecutors, and they were sent on Republican National Committee accounts, which Democrats say should only have been used for non-governmental business. The White House and the RNC say there's no cover-up. It's a system mistake. Well, Seth Stern is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. He joins us from Washington. Seth, Senator Leahy also compared this to the famous 18-minute gap in the Nixon White House tapes from the Watergate era. What is the thinking? Does he have a point? Don't even deleted emails have to live somewhere?
The argument Senator Leahy's making and other Democrats is that the Republicans are, the White House is trying to hide something here that they really just don't want to give up, that they do have the emails. On the other hand, you have the RNC, the Republican National Committee, saying that we used to delete our emails as a matter of course. We would just purge our system for emails that were older than 30 days. That was the practice before August 2004. And more recently, they say that individual users of these accounts could erase their emails, their old emails, from the server. And that was a practice until as recently as a month ago.
But from the servers, you're saying, because some people say even if you, and we want to remind people, even if you delete or erase your own emails, they still live somewhere.
I'm hardly the computer expert,
okay.
but it seems that that's certainly the suspicion of Senator Leahy. He sent a letter yesterday to Fred Fielding saying, let's get together, find a computer forensics expert, someone who can recover these. He thinks they're hiding somewhere.
Well, the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington says it believes the White House has lost more than 5 million emails sent between 2003 and 2005. The White House again saying it's just the process and they've since fixed it. What kind of messages were being sent on this other RNC account and who was sending them?
At issue here is that the White House is saying that there's a simple explanation here, that these are people who serve dual roles. They have a political role as well as their policy role, and that under the Hatch Act, the law that prohibits them from engaging in outside political activity, that they have to, just like a member of Congress, if they want to raise money, has to go use a phone outside of their congressional office, that these White House officials, if they want to conduct political business for the party, have to use a separate phone, computer, email account. Mm-hmm. So they're saying that sometimes, perhaps inadvertently, they would also conduct policy business on these email accounts. So it's just an accident. The Democrats are a little skeptical.
Well, you mentioned White House Counsel Fred Fielding. There are talks going on between the White House and the Judiciary Committees over the email issue, but also ongoing talks about whether White House officials will answer questions under oath about these ousted attorneys. Where do those talks stand?
It seems that it's still at a complete standstill. Yesterday there was an exchange of letters. Mr. Fielding sent his latest letter to congressional leaders and essentially said, I am not moving from the offer that I presented to you last month. It's take it or leave it. You can have the witnesses, but without under oath, without a transcript, and we're not going to give you any emails unless you agree to the whole deal as a package. So there's not a lot of movement so far.
Well, and all of this is going on just ahead of the much-anticipated appearance of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez before Patrick Leahy's committee next week. Where do you think this is headed?
That's going to be the big moment for the Attorney General, sort of a lot of build-up, and he's got a lot of explaining to do as far as the Democrats are saying. Yesterday, Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, who's sort of taken the lead on this issue, said, I don't knows, I don't recalls are not going to be acceptable. They want answers. They want explanations.
Seth Stern, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, speaking to us, too, from Washington. Seth, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Don Imus is off the air, but he is being forgiven.
He was remorseful. He expressed his apology. We've accepted his apology. This team and I would like to heal. We are in the process of forgiving. We have accepted his apology.
That was C. Vivian Stringer, coach of the Rutgers women's basketball team, speaking today after meeting with Imus last night to apologize for when he apologized for his racist and misogynistic on-air remarks. Meantime, Imus's wife Deirdre took his place on the air today to wrap up a fundraiser for research into SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome. And while doing so, she said that the players told her last night they were getting hate mail. Deirdre Imus said, "Don't send hate mail to them. Send it to my husband." CBS Radio fired Imus yesterday, a day after MSNBC pulled the simulcast of the radio show from its schedule. So what happens now? Joining us with more are Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. Melissa, welcome back.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
We have Mark Jerkowitz as well, Associate Director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
And Laura Washington, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to take a look today at the controversy and where it goes from here, because as we are hearing from many in the African-American community in particular, there's a concern that maybe it goes away. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, I want to go to you first, though, and get your response. What do you think of the fact that the Rutgers team has, at least according to its coach, decided to forgive Imus?
Oh, I mean, I think that that is an indication of what upstanding and wonderful young women they've shown themselves to be throughout the course of the year and throughout this really painful event. I don't think that it bears on the question of whether or not he should be punished and has been punished for his actions, but I think that it certainly reflects something about the character of these women.
Well, the coach went on to say he should be given some space. We'll have more of her remarks in a moment. But Laura Washington, there's not one community here speaking with one voice on any side of this issue, not within the African-American community, not within the radio community. Start with the African-Americans. What are you hearing?
Well, I think that's one of the important, valuable lessons that should come out of this. The African-American community has never been monolithic, and no one really speaks for us across the board. I think I'm hearing a couple things. One thing I'm hearing is that African Americans resent the attempt by Imus and his defenders to relate to the rappers and to other areas of our community, comedians, that kind of thing, who have used racial epithets and to try to draw similarities and to say, well, why fire him if you're not going to fire the others? That's one sentiment, and I happen to disagree with that. But the other sentiment is that we need to really start to take a close look at how we see each other in the community, how we treat each other, and to get past some of the self-hatred that I think provokes this kind of commentary. If we allow ourselves to have these kinds of conversations among ourselves, demeaning, denigrating conversations, then we certainly can't police others.
Well, and Melissa Harris, just picking up on that, I'm just scanning the talk shows this morning. I, for instance, heard an African American also say resent that Al Sharpton became the spokesperson on this issue. He's saying, for instance, that Al Sharpton called the Central Park jogger a whore. This is the white woman who, it turned out, had been attacked by some youths in Central Park. And Al Sharpton never apologized. This has also become a conversation about leadership in the black community.
Perhaps it has, but I mean, that said, and I think there's plenty of room to critique Reverend Sharpton on all kinds of areas, as well as to point to some of the good work that Reverend Sharpton has done. But I think, you know, most centrally, it is not at all clear to me that the behaviors internally of a community mean that that community therefore deserve to be attacked, particularly within the context of American racial history. And I think that the most difficult part of this is that it keeps us focused on the idea that racism is really about name-calling, and it keeps us from thinking much more carefully about the structural, institutional, and historical elements of racism.
Well, and I want Mark Jerkowitz to jump in here, because tying in with that, Melissa, that is has been some of the criticism, that this is sort of an easy mark, that everybody can kind of feel good, but in fact, what does it accomplish? Mark Jerkowitz, your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure what it accomplishes if you're looking at an accomplishment to come out of this, but I'd say a couple of things. Number one, I do think that this is not just a little speed bump, and that in 2 weeks everybody will be back to normal and every shock jock in America will be doing what they were doing and we'll all have forgotten about this. I think this is a little bit more in terms of media behavior, maybe as a Janet Jackson moment, which was when broadcasters recognized, whether they liked it or not, that the Federal Communications Commission in that case was going to start cracking down on certain behaviors. And there really was a degree of introspection and looking and thinking in the industry about what people could and could not get away with. Now, this was a private sector matter. It turned out that Imus's own bosses decided that he was a liability. But my sense is now that when people who sign the checks are starting to make the kinds of statements that, for example, Les Moonves made yesterday, that there is going to be, on some level, some rethinking of the culture on talk radio and other media outlets by both the talent and the people who hire them.
Do you really think that? Because
I wouldn't have said it if I didn't.
Yes, I know, obviously. but and I want Laura and Melissa Harris to jump in as well. But, you know, the thinking is that, you know, we have these burps, you know, every several years. And we have these spasms, and then they go away. Laura, jump in on that.
Well, you know, the Hurricane Katrina example is the most recent one. There was a lot of outrage and hand-wringing over many of the racial and economic stereotypes that were put forward by the media during that debacle. Not to say that there wasn't a lot of good journalism done either, and there was a lot of talk, and a lot of the national anchors talked about we're going to have to really look at more closely at our reporting stats, look more closely at how we approach communities communities of color like New Orleans. And I think that conversation has all faded away, and it's we've gone back to business as usual. Whenever race comes up, it comes up in a very sensational context, and when there's again a lot of agonizing, but not many concrete things change. You look at one reason why Don Imus is able to do what he did is that there is very little in the way of control among people of color and women of our TV and radio airways. Less than 10% of TV and radio stations are owned by people of color or women. That's a problem a concrete problem that can be addressed. But I don't think it's going to be addressed coming out of this conversation.
Melissa Harris Lacewell, you were speaking also of, you know, I think it was you. Speaking of the resentment that Don Imus had tied this to the rap culture, we are thinking of Snoop Dogg comments. He weighed in on this whole controversy. Okay, you're laughing, saying that he distanced himself by Don Imus by saying, "When we talk about this way, we're not talking about no collegiate basketball girls who've made it to the next level of education in sports. We're talking about hoes that's in the hood that ain't doing blank, that's trying to get an N-word for his money. These are two separate things."
Well,
your
okay,
thoughts.
So, I mean, well, the funniest part of it is anytime you have gone to a place where Snoop Dogg does not want to be associated with you because you are so deeply immoral, that is a good moment for self-reflection. But beyond that, I mean, never mind the troubling elements of what Snoop is saying there. What I think is important is that in both cases, we completely leave out the more important story. So the real hoes who get paid off of black male entertainers and athletes are not African-American women. They're white male record executives. So who gets paid and who we sort of have this story about has everything to do with these broader conceptions of gender and race in our country, which we have to be able to have a better conversation about.
That's Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African-American Studies at Princeton University. We've also been speaking with columnist Laura Washington, media critic Mark Jerkowitz. We're going to continue to do so when we come back. After a minute break, the fallout from the Don Imus firing. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about how the Don Imus controversy reflects what's happening in the media, in American culture, and we want to welcome to our conversation Clarence Page, syndicated columnist working out of the Chicago Tribune. And Clarence, you actually got Don Imus at one point to make an on-air pledge that he would not use this kind of language. Your thoughts on his firing?
Well, first of all, you're right. The folks who say that, why don't you give Don Imus another chance, don't know history, because back in 2000, before Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or anyone else, or much of anybody else, showed a lot of interest, there were news stories then, particularly by Philip Nobile, of a New York freelancer who chronicled a lot of different abusive statements and abusive comedy on IMUS program against blacks, Jews, Catholics, you name it. As people said, equal opportunity offender. So I'm not shedding any tears. Don Imus has been getting fired from radio since the 1970s, when he was one of the fathers of this trash talk shock jock radio form. And at that time, he was fired in New York. He went back to Cleveland and worked his way back up the food chain. I suspect he can just hop over to Satellite XM following his old buddy Howard Stern.
Well, that brings up a question. There are some people who are wondering what this accomplishes, if it makes some of the media companies involved and some of the advertisers and some of the leaders, the African-American community leaders who have stood up here, feel as if they've accomplished something, when in fact it just sort of brushes it all under the rug, or in media terms, brushes it over to XM. Mark, I want to bring Mark Jerkowitz back in, someone who's followed the media so closely. You say no. You say you think there are going to be some changes.
First of all, no one's suggesting that what Don Imus said or what happened to him is going to change the racial equation in America. But I'm talking about the behavior of the media. And in fact, it does change and has changed over time. And in the recent atmosphere, of the FCC crackdown in recent years, I know for a fact that radio stations had their legal counsels come in and talk to talent about what they could and could say, and changes were made. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen now. The other thing is that everybody's assuming that Don Imus is going to go to XM Radio. And I would throw a few caveats out there. One thing, Don Imus is not a young man. You never know, frankly, how somebody is going to respond to something like this happening. And he may just decide, I'm going to the ranch in New Mexico to be with the kids, and I've had it. I've had a great long run. So the other point is, and we should point this out from a media standpoint, the two major satellite providers are trying to merge. My understanding is that's going to require some kind of governmental oversight and regulation. And at this point, Don Imus may be a little too radioactive in that process to end up immediately at one of those satellite stations. So I wouldn't be so quick to say, hey, it's a burp, Imus will be back, you'll be making $8 million in 2 weeks. I don't see that.
Well, about 4 weeks.
Well, I want to ask Melissa Harris-Lacewell if we're even focusing on the right person. You've heard the name Don Imus quite a bit in the last few minutes, and you all know that Jason Whitlock, columnist for the Kansas City Star, wrote the now famous article that Imus isn't the real bad guy, that we're focusing on the wrong guy, that Don Imus has given black people, as he writes, an excuse to avoid our real problem. Melissa, you were commenting on that.
Yes, well, again, this is pretty standard way to talk about racism, is to claim that racial inequality is really the fault of black pathology, rather than, it's all these bad behaviors by particularly urban, young African Americans who are somehow squandering the work of the civil rights movement generation. But we just have to recognize that throughout history, black people have behaved badly and behaved well. But the constant has been racial inequality. So at some point, we are going to, as much as it's important to have internal conversations about the ethical ways in which we do or don't treat one another, we also have to acknowledge that it is the choices made by government, by policymakers, that leads to the continuing racial inequality in America. Firing Don Imus was important, but it doesn't get New Orleans rebuilt.
Laura Washington, I want to bring you back in as well, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Your thoughts on Jason Whitlock, because what has actually been, the word for it, but energizing in a funny way, has been to see this dialogue playing out. More African-Americans than I've ever seen, actually, or at least in recent memory, on major media outlets, but having this sort of debate, which maybe have been carried out inside the African-American community. Laura, your thoughts on that?
It's very difficult and very painful to have an external debate about these very sensitive, very provocative issues, as Melissa Harris-Lacewell has pointed out. But I think whether we have it internally or externally, I think we need to have it in a very honest and organic way. And I don't think we have done that to this point. And I think that creates two problems. One, it doesn't allow us to heal from these wounds. It doesn't allow us to move past the Snoop Dogs and the Don Imus and reclaim our culture and our history and not allow folks to denigrate it the way they have. And if we expect to be taken seriously by the outside world, we have to take responsibility for our weaknesses and for our problems in the community. We can't expect others to treat us with respect if we don't treat ourselves with respect. And if we're not honest about the fact that we do have issues, whether they're historically based or whether they're media based or wherever they're coming from, that we have to address them.
Clarence Page, the Reverend Sharpton said that he would now turn his attention to the rappers and to that language. You know, fair is fair. Do you think he should? I mean, is this something that the marketplace should work out? I mean, how can you do that? What can happen?
First of all, again, some history. Black folks have been protesting this misogynistic rap for years. Queen Latifah had a Grammy-winning song, UNITY, that talked about, I am not a hoe. There was C. Dolores Tucker, just died a couple of years ago, who crusaded all the way to Capitol Hill and bought stock in the big record companies to protest this language. It's just a bum rap that black folks haven't been fighting back. I think, you know, once again, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, whom I've been covering for three decades, will follow the light of publicity, so I hope we will get something, get some progress on this now.
That's syndicated columnist Clarence Page. You also spoke to Laura Washington, a writer as well, Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and Melissa Harris-Lacewell of Princeton University. Thank you all for helping us continue this conversation so it doesn't just stop now that Don Imus has stopped his program. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll continue it in the future. Next week, we'll take a look at the importance of that word nappy and hair. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What was the governor of New Mexico doing this week in North Korea? Bill Richardson was formally there to collect the remains of six U.S. soldiers killed during the Korean War, and he had a say in negotiations over North Korea's nuclear program. But Governor Richardson, a Democrat, is running for president of the United States, the first Hispanic to do so. And his trip can't help but remind voters that he also was a congressman from New Mexico for 14 years, and President Clinton's U.N. ambassador and energy secretary. Well, today we begin a series of profiles of presidential candidates, starting with Richardson. Not everyone knows that the 59-year-old is the son of a Boston banker and a Mexican woman. As a child, he played in the streets of a Mexican barrio and attended high society lawn parties and the private Middlesex school here in Concord, Massachusetts. Well, joining us on the phone from New Mexico is Tom Cole, investigative reporter for the Albuquerque Journal, who co-authored a lengthy 5-part biographical series on Richardson. Tom, what about him jumps out at you?
His resume, of course. A long career of public service beginning in 1982, as you said, 14 years in the Congress, a couple years as U.N. ambassador, and a couple years as energy secretary.
How about his style? I mean, there in New Mexico, he's been called both King Bill and a grandstanding bully. He pushed through a spaceport for space tourism, for instance, there in New Mexico. His supporters say he's a force of nature and a regular guy. He seems to have equal voices on both sides.
But he is many things. He is a serious politician, but on the other side, he has a very affable personality, a person that is very good at the handshaking business of being a politician.
And not afraid of going out, as we said, as a regular guy. We had a smile at the image you painted of him making a major speech with tomato sauce on his shirt.
Yeah.
Well, you write that through necessity, he's had to develop an ease at moving between the poor and the rich, Spanish and English, Mexico and the U.S. His dad, his very stern father, raising him in Mexico City, expected him to memorize the encyclopedia, be A-plus in everything. Then he came to a private school, a fish out of water with a Spanish accent. How did he go from a prep school kid in New England and somebody who worked in Washington to governor of New Mexico? How did he win over New Mexico? Did he have any ties with the state?
When he moved here, he had no ties to the state. In fact, he and his wife were examining the possibility of going to California or Florida. He was looking for a state with an Hispanic population of significance, and he chose New Mexico. When he first came here, he got involved in Democratic politics, and within a couple years, he nearly knocked off a veteran congressman in 1980 and in his first campaign, and that caught people's attention big time. Bill Richardson is a relentless campaigner and hard worker, And that's one of his biggest assets, and that's how he got elected to Congress from this state.
How would you describe his politics?
Well, he's a centrist Democrat. He's always kind of been in the middle, against gun control, but for the death penalty, for balanced budgets, for tax cuts, for abortion rights, but against gay marriage. So he's a Democrat who can appeal to a great number of voters on both sides of the political spectrum.
When he was Clinton's U.N. ambassador for just over a year, he had to testify about interviewing Monica Lewinsky, for instance, for a U.N. job, saying he wasn't pressured by anyone. So are some of these things going to be brought up?
He did interview Monica Lewinsky at the request of the White House, offered her a job. She didn't take it. He did get involved at when he was Energy Secretary, in probably his darkest moment as a public official, over security leaks and the Chinese spy scandal. And so there are things in his past that...
This is when there were spying charges against scientist Wenho Li. They were ultimately dropped. Also, laptops went missing from the department.
Yes. He was also Energy Secretary at a time when gasoline prices spiked, really hurt him politically, but I think he's recovered from that for the most part.
Right. Some say that killed his chance to be Al Gore's running mate in 2000, all of those things. We find it interesting, Tom, given the news of the day, that Richardson had his own spat with Don Imus. This was just last month, and it was over the lack of state funding for a school renovation project that is near Imus's ranch there in New Mexico. Imus ended up calling Richardson a fat sissy, told him in Spanish to kiss his rear end, according to reports. Because Imus felt that Richardson wasn't, the state wasn't getting the money fast enough. Richardson did get the state legislature to pony up, $600,000 for the school renovation. And I think Imus, in the end, said that Richardson should be the next president of the United States.
Right. They did make up, which is not surprising. I mean, before Don Imus was kicked off the air, I mean, he was a substantial influence in the political arena, and Bill Richardson has appeared on his show several times and has been a supporter of the ranch.
Does that anecdote tell us more about Don Imus or something about Bill Richardson, that he responded to that?
Maybe a little of both. You know, the state right now is flush with a lot of money.
Well, the state may be flush, but Bill Richardson is not. He his coffers aren't very full, and he's not doing very well in the polls. What is your thinking about his chances here?
Well, I think his chances are tied very much to the front runners, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and to some degree Senator Edwards. I mean, should they stumble, I think he is a likely candidate for the voters to turn to. But at the same time, we have a long way to go here, and he does have enough money to run relatively good campaigns in the early primary and caucus states. And if he can catch fire, it's certainly not unheard of in presidential politics for a long shot to come in.
As we leave, just list us Bill Richardson's qualities and his faults.
Well, his biggest qualities I think he has going for him are his resume, his experience in foreign policy and domestic policy. He is a very hard worker. I mean, this is a guy who 24/7 is on the job, whether it was in Congress or in the Clinton administration or as governor. He likes to be on the move, and I think that is his greatest asset right now.
And the fault?
Well, he has had some trouble with the truth in the past. There has been controversy about whether he was drafted as to play Major League Baseball. He was a star baseball player, but in fact was not drafted, as he had claimed over the years.
He also said he was a top aide to Senator Hubert Humphrey, and that apparently wasn't true.
Right. So these resume issues, they're very easy for people and voters to understand, and he is open to an attack on those issues.
Tom Cole, investigative reporter for the Albuquerque Journal. Tom, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, and before we go today, you might not know Thelma Schoonmaker's name, but you know her work, Raging Bull, The Departed. We'll meet the editor before we go. You're listening to Here and Now. Hockey playoffs underway, Bad Boy football player suspended, Daisuke derailed. It's been a busy week in sports, and joining us, as he always does, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, nice to see you again.
Daisuke wasn't derailed. Come on. He didn't pitch quite as well as the other guy, but we'll get to that. Okay.
We're looking for another D there. but before we do that, we want to talk about the Duke story. As we reported here, you know, lawyers for these three former Duke lacrosse players considering suing Durham County District Attorney Mike Nifong. He's the one who pursued the rape and sexual assault charges against them. They were declared innocent this week by the state attorney general. There may be lawsuits all around. The kids and their parents may also sue Duke. Are we near the end of this saga?
Well, Robin, in the world in which we live, it probably depends on what vile event next transpires to kick this one off the front pages. You don't want to root for vile events. I'm afraid we're not. We haven't seen the end of this because there's just too much for lawyers still to do, and lawsuits seem to be the way of the way things go.
And the young men did have their, they were kicked off the team and their season canceled before they were even tried.
Right, so. And they're going to have to pick things up where they left off, right. and more power to them. I hope things go well for them here on out.
National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell has suspended Tennessee Titans quarterback Adam Pac-Man Jones and Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chris Henry. Jones was involved in a fight and a shooting at a strip club that left one man paralyzed. Henry has been arrested four times in a 14-month span, including incidents involving alcohol and reckless operation of a car. So, new NFL conduct policy from the new commissioner. Is this a new sheriff in town?
It's a new sheriff in town, and he's taking advantage of the fact that he is the new sheriff to put a new policy in place. And I guess the idea for the National Football League is they want the image to be clean enough so the corporations will continue to support it at great expense. On the other hand, they don't want to take responsibility for the terrible injuries suffered by some of the men playing their sport. And if you got a concussion and 10 years later you can't remember your phone number, don't go to the NFL for help because they're still not willing to provide much of it.
Okay, moving to baseball. This week, Boston Red Sox pitcher, it's Daisuke. That's how you're supposed to pronounce
right,
it.
Right, they simplified it for us here in the States.
So at the game the other night, everybody was dressed with, they had all dice hanging off them, these big dice.
I wonder if he knows what this means. What is all this with the dice?
Right, but anyway, Daisuke Matsusaka, he took the mound for that big game at Fenway Park. Derail's not the right word. It was a one-hit shutout performance from Seattle pitcher Felix Hernandez. I was at the game, and it was going very quickly, up, down, up, down. And I turned to my nephew. I thought, I'm so sorry. What a boring game. He said, Robin, we're watching a pitching duel. This is almost a no-hitter.
Right. I love the fact that the commentary on it was Hernandez didn't change his game plan, which was to get ahead of the hitters and throw first-pitch strikes. That's everybody's game plan. What he did was he put the game plan into effect marvelously well. That's why he succeeded. And Daisuke pitched very well. But he was the second-best pitcher that night.
Right. Okay. We just want to say the 111th running of the Boston Marathon does take place here on Monday. They may be in galoshes and on their skis because there's a terrible storm coming in. But there's a rumor going across the country that it's going to be canceled because of this storm. So far, they say no. But do you think we're going to see men and women from other nations?
No. I mean, if they run the thing on skis, it's the only way the Kenyans can be prevented from winning it. They're not very good on skis. We do have a piece in our show this week about an organization called the USA Distance Project, which has been aimed at developing U.S. distance runners and making them more competitive. And their hope is that success in that along that line will be evident in Monday's race.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. I know you've been thinking about this. This Sunday marks the 60th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's first game, first black to win, to play in Major League Baseball. And here we have the firing of Don Imus for racially insensitive remarks. Your thoughts on how these two events collide?
Well, I think it's a little bit difficult to sort of talk about the two at once. Don Imus made a perfectly stupid and uninformed comment. It was no different from a lot of the things that Don Imus has been saying for a long time. I think the reason he got clobbered was because his targets were 18- and 19-year-old women pursuing degrees. And a lot of people said, hey, hold it. Wait a minute. That's way below the belt.
Right. Leave that for the politicians, if for anyone. Bill Littlefield covers sports much more each weekend, and I'm sure he'll have some thoughts on that anniversary as well this weekend. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, before we go, we're going to meet editor Thelma Schoonmaker, the woman behind Martin Scorsese's films. That's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Please give a warm welcome to Thelma Schoonmaker.
This week, the Coolidge Corner Movie Theater here in Brookline, Massachusetts, gave its fourth annual Coolidge Award to three-time Oscar winner Thelma Schoonmaker. If you don't know that name, you know her films. She won those Academy Awards for Raging Bull, The Aviator, and this year's winner of Best Picture, Martin Scorsese's The Departed. Here's Jack Nicholson opening the film.
I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me. Years ago, we had the church. That was only a way of saying we had each other.
Thelma Schoonmaker won her Oscar for editing that scene and many others. She's a master at taking a multitude of takes and shaping them into a film. For over 25 years, she's worked alongside Martin Scorsese, who, by the way, picked up his first Oscar this year for directing The Departed. Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham sat down with Thelma Schoonmaker when she was here in Boston, and Renee began by congratulating Thelma on her most recent Oscar.
Thank you. It was quite a thrill. Plus, Marty winning made it even better.
What was it like for you? You've worked with him for so long to finally see him win an Oscar.
It's made a big difference, you know, in him. He's sort of, something's changed. He's really been changed by it, and that's lovely to see. It was such a bitter thing for all of us, not so much for him, but it was very bitter for all of us who work with him to have him, you know, not given Best Director for a film like Raging Bull, for heaven's sakes. I mean, how could you not do that? So it's been very painful over the years. It's not why we make movies, of course, but it was very painful.
Your editing decisions are so integral to the way the film is shaped and the way the performances are shaped. Do you ever feel like, and this is no disrespect for Martin Scorsese, like a kind of co-director?
No, I don't, because Scorsese has such strong conceptual ideas about his movies, and those aren't mine. But I do love helping him get his vision up there on the screen. It's a wonderful job because you get such great, great footage. A lot of editors get crappy footage, and then they have to try and make something work out of it. I'm very lucky. I'm given incredibly good footage to work with, which is a dream.
I've heard that, and I've read that you don't spend a lot of time on the set of the films you're going to edit. Why is that?
I don't go on the set a lot. I love to watch Marty and the actors work, but it's better for me to keep a cold eye and not lose my perspective by being on the set and have the crew say to you, oh, we just laid 40 feet of track and we're going to do this incredible tracking shot. And I would rather see it cold up on the screen first thing in the morning and see for myself if I feel, you know, exhilaration about it or not.
We want to take you through one of the clips from Raging Bull, which was, you know, Martin Scorsese's 1980 masterpiece based on the rise and fall of middleweight boxer Jake LaMotta.
Round number 13, the hard luck number. There's the buzzer, and I think you know both the boys.
The final fight scene in Raging Bull is when Jake LaMotta finally loses to Sugar Ray Robinson and his great rival. And he will not go down. He was famous for saying he would never go down. And Sugar Ray Robinson can't figure out why, even though he's pummeled this man, he still will not go down. And what Scorsese and the cameraman came up with was the idea of having Sugar Ray Robinson pull back and try and figure out what was going on with LaMotta. So as Sugar Ray pulled back and stood and thought, they had the camera ramp down to slow motion and automatically adjusted the light so that everything got very dark, and the camera was automatically adjusting its exposure at that moment. And you just hear our sound editor, our brilliant sound editor, Frank Warner, just told us the best thing to do at that moment was silence. He said silence is often much more powerful than sound. So he said, let's make it very quiet. So we made it very quiet. We took away all the crowd noise, and all you hear is very light animal breathing, as if either Sugar Ray or Jake LaMotta is breathing like an animal. You just hear it very faintly. This is a terrifying, quiet moment. And then, as Sugar Ray comes in for the kill, he raises up his hand, and the camera ramps up to normal speed, and the lights come back up again. Very, very beautifully conceived idea by Scorsese. The fight sequence is filled with ideas like that. And Jake, or Bob De Niro, had to spend days and days and days getting hit in the head from the right where water would spray off, or hit in the head from the left where blood would spray off. We even put shots in upside down. And these were all part of a montage that Marty had designed, very intense montage, to give the feeling of this terrible beating that he was taking, but would not go down.
Never went down, right? He never got me down, right?
Did he have their scenes already, were they on storyboards? Did he already know exactly the sequence he wanted them in? And how did you work with him in getting those scenes together?
He did have storyboards for this montage that you're talking about, where Sugar Ray is pummeling LaMotta, but because while we were cutting it, the film was telling us sometimes different things to do emotionally or kinetically, we did violate that storyboard structure somewhat. But basically, the entire scene was thought out very, very carefully. Marty often shot some of the shots three different speeds, 120 frames a second, 96 frames per second, and 72 frames per second, and then we would choose which one was best within the edit.
You've worked with Martin Scorsese so long. Have you developed a kind of shorthand in the editing room?
Yes, there's an enormous amount of trust between us, and he often doesn't have to tell me things. I know already what he's going to like or not like in a performance or something else in the film, because I've just worked with him for so many years. Yes, there is a shorthand. There's a great deal we don't have to say to each other. But he does talk to me constantly in dailies. One of the most important times for me in filmmaking is when I sit with him every night. He's looking at the footage he shot the day before, and he talks to me constantly, and I write like the wind, fortunately. And I write down everything he says about what he's seeing. I hate that, you know, don't ever show me that again. Or this is great. I'm pushing the actor a certain way, and he's not there yet, so probably the next take will be better, and so forth and so on. And then my own notes also, I combine those two, and then I start putting the film together from that.
I took a film class in college, and one of the films we watched was Raging Bull. And after the film, my professor said, behind every great director, there's a great editor. What's your response to that observation?
Well, every great director is a good editor. That's my that's my observation. I think that there's no doubt, if you look at the careers of great directors like Scorsese, like my husband, Michael Powell, they all learned editing very early in their careers. You have to know about editing in order to be a good director. And I wish more directors today did know more about editing, although more and more directors are in the editing room and they're learning constantly. But it's just a bulwark of filmmaking, editing. It's so important.
Do you think film editors get the credit they deserve?
Film editors are getting much more credit than they ever used to. For some reason, there's been a new appreciation of what editors do. An editor can make or break a film. An editor can make or break an actor's performance by using the wrong takes or staying too long on an actor instead of cutting away. You can make a film too slow. You can make a film too fast. An editor is critical in how a film comes together. And so it just could not be more important. And all great filmmakers know that.
Academy Award-winning film editor Thelma Schoonmaker speaking with Here Now's Renee Graham. By the way, Renee's Thelma on that piece was our own Emiko Tamagawa. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.